And also, of course, a material can go from one type of order to another one through a phase transition. And now the fundamental work from Lander was that he observed that these different kinds of orders actually correspond to different kinds of symmetries. And a state undergoing a phase transition actually means it goes from one ordered state, which has a certain symmetry, to another state, which has a different kind of symmetry. And the fundamental key issue here is now that if you want to distinguish these Landau phases, you can always define a local observable order parameter to distinguish these two states. So just a very, very two simple examples are, of course, if you have a liquid, you have a continuous translational symmetry. If you make a phase transition to a crystal, then these continuous translational symmetry gets broken down to discrete lattice translational symmetry. So in this way, the symmetry gets reduced. And you can define yourself an order parameter in order to distinguish the two phases. And the other classical example is, of course, you consider yourself an Ising model on the square lattice. There are two phases. One is the ferromagnetic phase, and the other phase, if you increase the temperature sufficient, then the material makes a transition to the ferromagnetic phase. And the order parameter, of course, which has a finite value in the ferromagnetic phase, is the magnetization here. And once you cross over to the other phase, in the paramagnetic phase, the magnetization is zero. So your order parameter is the magnetization. That's a local observable parameter. So that's just, this was very successful. And for a long time, people thought that Landau symmetry breaking can actually capture or describe the phases of, it can describe everything, and every at least continuous phase transition. But actually, that turned out not to be true. And it actually was, I guess, your own Shouwang Wang, who in the late 80s, I guess he introduced this notion of topological order, where he said actually that there are states which lie beyond Landau symmetry breaking. So you cannot define a local order parameter because there is no local observable symmetry broken. And this requires you to introduce a new set of properties, or even some people call it quantum numbers, in order to distinguish between these different topologically ordered states. And one important issue is, of course, these topological systems are usually gapped systems. And the point is now that the new thing, once your system lives on a non-trivial surface, the simplest non-trivial surface is the torus here, then you observe a ground state degeneracy. And another issue is that usually in classical systems, you only have integer fractionalization. In this case, you have fractionalized quasi-particle excitations. And also we distinguish that these excitations can obey different statistics. So they can be either abelian or non-abelian. So our talk will eventually discuss a non-abelian system. And just to round up and further set the stage, I will just go back to the 80s. So, and then I make a connection to today's work. So just in the early 80s, actually, I guess this was an experimental breakthrough when people discovered the fractional quantum Hall effect. And very quickly, Laughlin made this fundamental contribution that he realized that this phase is an incompressible quantum liquid with fractionalized excitations. This is a very famous paper. But this was in the early 80s. And I guess the notion of topological order was actually 1989. So it was actually in the late 80s when people tried to make an effort to understand high-TC superconductors. That's when people constructed chiral spin states. And they hoped that this would help them to gain understanding what's going on in the high-TC superconductors. And the point is now that the people realize that these chiral spin states, they break time reversal symmetry and parity, and they are spin rotationally invariant. And according to Landau's principle, that should be it. But people realize quickly that there are multiple chiral spin states, which cannot be distinguished by this classical order. And from, I guess, this was kind of the birth hour of topological order, when people realized that you can define yourself something which tells this chiral spin liquids apart. So actually, unfortunately, the chiral spin liquid failed to provide an understanding of what's going on in the superconductors. But nonetheless, people realized that the chiral spin states have similarities to these fractional quantum Hall states. So then people went back to the early 80s and actually realized that we have a topologically ordered system which is experimentally has been investigated. So there's an experimental setup which proves evidence that topologically order actually exists. So this so I guess in this case both theory people and experimental people were happy. So when you say, do you know states which exhibit topological order, you can say the quantum Hall states. Everyone will believe you that. And then you can say, is there another type of states which also are topologically ordered? And then you can say, yes, there are various quantum spin liquids in the literature which have also topological order. So this is just very famous results. You know the Diamond model on the triangular and on the Kagame lattice by Messner and so on, the Mesquish, which is a Z2 Diamond liquid. Yeah, like I said, my PhD thesis was actually constructing an actual spin model on the Kagame lattice, which is also lies in the Z2 phase. And then there's the toric code and so on. So in this case, I mean, here you have, you know, this is probably, most people maybe know this. This is the RK point wave function. This is an equal amplitude superposition of RBB states. And now people say, can I make a connection between spin liquids and quantum Hall states? And actually you can. You can construct yourself spin liquid wave function out of a quantum Hall type wave function. And we are actually not the first ones to do this. Actually, the first one who did this were actually in the late 80s, like I already mentioned, Keimer and Laughlin, who built a chiral spin liquid state, which is a spin 1/2 state, and it's of abelian nature. So we will just spend a little bit of time on this state because it can be seen as some kind of precursor to our state. Because our state that I want to actually investigate and introduce to you is a non-abelian version of the Keimer-Laughlin state. It's called the Moreed chiral spin liquid state. And this is now, it's non-abelian in nature, and it's a spin 1 system, so no longer a spin 1/2. So but also for historical reasons, and also to draw another analogy between these two states, I will just focus on the Keimer-Laughlin state from the late 80s. So this is your Keimer-Laughlin state introduced in 87. What Keimer and Laughlin did, they actually took the bosonic fractional quantum Hall wave function at half filling. This is given here. So this is a continuum wave function. So the bosons live on a complex plane. These are complex coordinates. And the wave function has this crucial ingredient that you have this Jastrow factor to the factor of 1 over V. And this factor has a consequence that no two bosons can sit on the exact same point in space. So double occupancy is not allowed. And people have investigated this wave function. And then the idea from Keimer and Laughlin was, we take this continuum wave function and force it to sit on a lattice now. In our case, we pick the square lattice here. And so you see, we fix our number of bosons to one boson for each two sides. And this wave function, this amplitude here, allows the sides to be either empty or single occupied by a boson, which is the blue dot here. And in order to draw this spin analogy, people say that you can say these spin downs here are the empty sides. And then these are creation operators, which create you the bosons here. So if you make this analogy with the spins, you identify the empty sides with spin down, and the creation operators create a spin up here, spin 1/2 up here. And that's why people called it a quantum Hall type spin liquid. So it's a chiral spin liquid. It breaks parity and time reversal symmetry, but it respects lattice symmetries and is spin rotation invariant. And in this case, it can be proven that this state is a singlet only in the thermodynamic limit, but not for a finite system. And so this is just one wave function living on a plane. And now the important feature comes, like I said, the topological degeneracy appears once you put the system on a non-trivial surface like a torus here. So what you now encounter is this twofold topological ground state degeneracy here. Actually, we are doing now the same over again. We just take our bosonic fraction quantum Hall system, but now we force it to live on a torus. Again, that's the old continuum wave function. And you see here this N is responsible for the twofold degeneracy. The N appears here. That's a center of mass term, which only appears for the case of the torus. And this, maybe experts know this, this is called a theta function. And there are actually four theta functions in the literature, and this is the first one. And you also see the Jastrow factor here appears again. Now it's not just the difference in the coordinates, but the coordinate difference is now the argument of this function. And this function also has this issue. Once the argument is zero, so two particles on the same place and on the plane, this vanishes. So actually, everything stays the same. You allow each side to be occupied by either one boson or by zero bosons. And yeah, once you sum over all these possible boson configurations, which again you can identify as up and down, you can construct yourself your spin one liquid wave function. And just, I forgot to mention, this is a gauge factor. You need this to ensure that you have a singlet. And once you live on a torus, you always have an exact singlet. There's an old Russian mathematical identity, Perov-Molov, which actually, in just a couple of lines, then you can prove this. So this state, these two states, 0 and 1, are always singlets, as long as you have an even number of sides.
This chemical is
in? Which is this one? Oh, this is the kind of the center of mass. It's just the sum over all particle coordinates. The actual center of mass would be you divide by 1 over n, but this doesn't appear. So it's kind of the center of mass. So this is actually from 87. And I just investigated this wave function a little bit because I didn't find it in the literature. So when you say this is topologically ordered, then you say local correlations should not be able to distinguish between the two ground states. And for this sake, it's almost 200 sides. This is the wave function psi 1. You see here the Heisenberg correlation, and here this is the ZZ component. And then you add the second wave function. Yeah, you see there's a nice overlap. The red curve now overlaps with the black one, and here the green one is quite exactly on top of the blue one, which means so local correlations can no longer distinguish between these two states. And also this is fulfilled since it's a singlet. And maybe one should note that when people say these states are topologically degenerate ground states, they have to exhibit the same kind of correlations. If you start with a very small system, like for example 2x2, you get very very different values for the correlation in distance one. So which means for a very small system, you can still distinguish with the states by local correlations. So strictly speaking, you don't have topological degeneracy. But already for a small system, I think 6x6 or something, these correlations overlap very, very well.
Because there's nothing in this model that lets you tune the correlation, is that right?
It's actually, in this sense, there is a parent Hamiltonian for this Kalman-Laughlin spin liquid. But actually, we just take the wave function for itself. So this should be a gap phase, and there's no strict proof, but gap phases should have exponential decay. And yeah, you can get this here. So this is actually just old stuff. So this people have been doing in the 90s and a little bit later. But so then nothing was done. But now you can take the game one step further. So like I said, the Kalman-Lapin spin liquid state is a spin 1/2 state, and it's a billion. And now you ask yourself, can I make a chiral spin liquid state which is non-abelian in nature? And actually you can. In order to make this, you now have to take a spin 1 system. And then you can formulate this this system for a droplet. And this was actually done by Greiter and Tumala in 2009. They did the same as Kalman and Laughlin. They started from a bosonic fraction quantum Hall state at filling 1 this time. This is the continuum wave function. It's called Mereed wave function. And then they built a spin liquid. Just a word to this wave function. You see, the crucial new point is now the Pfaffian. The Pfaffian should be responsible for non-abelian statistics. I mean, for this wave function, it is known that it's a non-abelian state. If this non-abelian property survives, once you make a spin liquid, that's actually the question. But the Pfaffian gives you usually non-abelian statistics. Then you again have this Jastrow factor here times 1 over V and this exponential. Now, remember I said the Kalman-Lapin state only allows one particle per side maximum. This now, actually if two bosons are at the same side, this here diverges. But actually it gets canceled by this factor here, which means two bosons can now sit on one side, but no more than two bosons. Once you put three bosons on one place on the plane or on the side, the wave function vanishes, which means a snapshot state would look like this. You can have an empty side, a single occupied side, or double occupied sides. And the number of double occupied sides is the same as the number of single occupied sides, since you have to fix the number of particles in your system here.
I don't understand why that's the case.
What?
Why is this inversion symmetric, spin inversion? Why is the number of SZ equals minus 1 equal to the number of SZ equals plus 1 states?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Why is the number of sites with SZ equal to minus 1 equal to the number of sites with SZ
this
equals here? Plus 1?
This? Yeah. Oh, no, this is just an identification. You can say... This is the occupation number. Yeah. It's just, you don't.
Why is the number of red circles equal to the number of empty sites?
Oh, because you have one flux quantum per facklet, which means you have one boson per side.
Yes.
Yeah, so, yeah. Yeah, one boson per side means technically you could put one boson on each side. And if I take one boson, put it on the other side, then I have one empty side and one double occupied side. So I have to fix the number of particles.
Okay, even there, but it doesn't seem like it's you're breaking spin inversion. The wave function not particle all symmetric, I think.
The wave function is.
So you're breaking a symmetry of the spin one model, no? Even though it's SZ equals zero.
Yeah, this is SZ equals zero.
But is the wave function symmetric under SZ goes to minus SZ?
Yes, it should be.
I don't think so.
Wait, you say SZ1 to minus SZ?
Just spin reflection symmetry, SZ goes to minus SZ.
Well, it should be symmetric under permutation of all the particles.
Sure,
yeah.
But I want to
Yeah, probably.
I want to permute empty sides with red sides.
Oh, No, they have different amplitudes in that case.
So it breaks?
Yes, it breaks. It breaks the symmetry.
Well, I don't depend on Hamiltonian. But
there is no Hamiltonian.
Can you prove it's a single Hamiltonian?
Yes. Yeah, you can prove this. And also the next step, if you put it on a torus, then it's always, as long as you have even number of sides, it's always a singlet. You can prove this analytically.
What is the proof rely on?
It's this Perumolov identity, which is just it's just an identity about lattice sites, and then you have to sum over the complex plane, and then you see that if you have a droplet, you need to go to the Turner limit in order to have a singlet. I want to comment on that. So, yeah, I wanted to just point out that in this case you are allowed to put two bosons on one side, but not more. And in this, with this information, you build now your spin one liquid wave function here. There you have these modified creation operators, and you also need a new gauge phase to ensure that this is a singlet. In this case, at least in the thermodynamic limit. And as we will see later, for a torus system, you always have a singlet state.
What does this word droplet signify for the lattice system? What does the word droplet convey? What does it mean for this system?
If you force it on a lattice?
Yeah.
The point why we actually do this is just we want to see if we if this non-abelian character, which is proved for this case, if it survives once you force the particles to sit on a lattice. Greta and Tomala have tried to discuss a little bit if there's a parent Hamiltonian, but they didn't succeed. So it's too complicated. There's no known parent Hamiltonian which has this as the exact ground state. So we just have to be satisfied that we have an interesting wave function which we can investigate. And this is actually what we do, just with the droplet case. And so you take your wave function, and then you make the simplest update scheme that you can do in variational Monte Carlo. So suppose you are here on a double occupied site, you take a boson and move it up. Then, which means we have now this side is now single occupied and this side also single occupied. You can also move it to your right, for example. Then you would make this would just have one boson left and this would be double occupied. Like I said, this wave function does not allow for more than two bosons on one side. So if you attempt to take a boson and move it to an already double occupied side, this wave function will not occur in the wave function. So this would be rejected. And now you see this is a droplet of 100 bosons. And if we let the simulation run, it looks like this. Yeah, so this is a sequence of snapshot states. You do this very simple update, and once the Monte Carlo runs, it basically looks like this. And the first thing that you do is, of course, you check the behavior of the correlation functions.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean that sequence of configurations are components of the wave function?
Yes, they are snapshots.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But I can't tell from that their amplitudes or their phases, or so I can't see everything that I might need to know about that wave function.
You want to extract these properties. I mean this is This is what you see here when I say these are snapshots. This means these are members of the sum.
Yeah.
But yeah.
The larger the output model, the more frequently you would have amplitude square. But it doesn't really remain a droplet. I mean, that's part of the
problem. What do you mean? It remains a droplet.
Well, that's what I was asking before. Do you have a kind of lattice drop?
I didn't a lattice what?
I mean, the occupancy is confined to a disk.
Yes, of course. I live on a disk.
A forced ring,
sorry. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is that forced, or is it just doing that on its own? I mean, is that just that?
No. You what you actually do is basically, or what people also do when they take the continuum wave function, you just place all these. You can calculate a radius, where you place all these sites so that you have one flux quantum per flux head. And then you let the simulation run. And what you see is that these particles remain in this area. So they do not spread out.
What controls the size of the drop?
The particle number.
So you calculate the theta functions?
Suppose you use the theta function to define a non-abelian wave function.
If you put it on a torus, then you have the theta function. So yeah. This is the next slide. Okay. Yeah. It's just
Do you assume part of the theorem
of do what?
Do you assume the part of the theorem? So has the blue part number change or not?
It is possible that usually the simplest case is I have this it's kind of a circular area, and I just put one boson per side. So my initial configuration is everything is blue, and then it can be that at a certain point there are more double occupied sides than single occupied sides. This is allowed. Yeah. So for a droplet case, you cannot do really so much because you only have one wave function. So, but what you can see is you check the correlation behavior. So here you see the blue line is the Heisenberg correlation measured along the x-axis from the center of the circular droplet. And the blue line is for 180 bosons, and I guess buried under the blue line is the black line for 100 bosons. So you see already for a rather small system size, the correlation behavior does not change. And here, this is the ZZ component, the red curve for 180 sites. And below the red, just under the red curve is the green one for a smaller system of 100 bosons. And now, can anybody tell me what this is? This is the on-site correlation of the ZZ component. And since in the thermodynamic limit, so we need a sufficiently large size system, this is a special value. It's two-thirds. You can just intuitively say we have a spin liquid, which means on an average you should have, it is possible to have either zero bosons, one boson, or two bosons per side. But on average, you should have one boson per side. And the boson has equal probability to be in a state spin 1, spin 0, or spin minus 1, which means this value here is 1 squared plus minus 1 squared plus 0 squared over 3 is 2/3. And if you start with a very small droplet like 2 by 2, you see some other value. So it's definitely not a singlet. But already, For 36 sites, you already see this. It's a 6x6 system. You see this is 0.666 very well achieved. And then you make your usual log plot to verify that this decay is exponential. That's basically all you can do for the droplet case. Maybe, yeah? You mean this? Yeah, maybe I wanted to show it. Yeah, people, for a droplet case, when I say I place the particles around the origin in a circular manner, and then I let it run. And it means in this area, usually the behavior of SZ is like in a spin liquid, which means it should be zero. But once you reach the end of this droplet, the boundary, you see this characteristic peak. So people have observed this peak. This means that they are no longer after this peak, there are no longer any bosons present. And this is just a boundary effect. So you see that in this case, it's not a singlet any longer. And people have observed this peak for the continuous wave function, and we just reproduced it for our lattice wave function. So this is actually all interesting stuff you can do if you only allow a droplet. So now the next step is to put it on a lattice, on a torus lattice. So now things get a little bit more complicated. So your situation is you have an n-side square lattice, and you build yourself a spin 1 chiral spin liquid. And Yeah, this is kind of old news. This is again the bosonic fracture control system for filling fraction one. And once this system lives on a torus, you encounter again this topological degeneracy, which is in this case threefold and no longer twofold like in the Kalman-Laughlin state. So here you have three distinctive ground state wave functions here, labeled by N. The N again appears in this center of mass term here, and also in the Pfaffian. So the Pfaffian argument now looks a little bit more complicated. And when I label my wave functions 1, 2, 3, this refers to theta 2, 3, and 4. Yeah, so like I said, there are actually four theta functions in the literature. And the theta 1 appears in all three wave functions, but these theta 2, 3, and 4 actually distinguish the three wave functions here, the ground state wave functions. And yeah, it's again only these arguments become now not just simple differences, but arguments of these theta functions. Here's again this Jastrow factor, which cancels in case that two bosons sit on the same place. So which means I allow double occupancy, but no more than two sides. Yeah, and that's basically it. So that's from the late 90s. And now people force this to live on a lattice. Yeah, I can do this. I again fix my particle number to one boson per side. And then my wave function looks like this. Yeah, this gauge factor again ensures that I have a singlet. And now as long as I have an even number of sides, I always have a singlet wave function. I can again prove this with this Perumolov identity, and I can also check in the numerics again for the on-site correlations, which I will do in a second. So note, Kalman-Laughlin is twofold degenerate. The Moreet chirospin liquid is threefold degenerate now.
So what happens in the case of odd number of sites?
Then it's not cannot be a singlet. We didn't actually look at this. I mean it cannot be the original state. It would be something different actually. You can only there's a technical detail. You actually have to watch. This is actually the wave function for even number by even number. I can do even by odd, as long as it's also an even number of particles. But then I need to do a little cosmetic tweaks on this. But that's possible. But in that case, it's also it's the same phase. An interesting property is also if you make a very small system like 2x2, this is actually no longer chiral because all these amplitudes become real. So it's then actually your wave function is actually not the real deal. But as long as you have an even number of sides and a system which we checked which is bigger than 2x2, then you have you're really in your chiral spin liquid state.
Exact singlet, you do mean that hit S plus on the whole wave function that gives you zero.
Yes. Yeah, you can show this. Yeah, I can show you the paper. It's an old Russian paper from 71. And also Greiter and Tomale did this for the droplet. And actually I can do this for the torus. Just in a similar way. Yeah. So this is now a 196 side system. Yeah, this is, I first restrict myself to only the first wave function. So here I have the Heisenberg correlation and here the ZZ component. You see here again, this is our two-thirds, which yeah, should be achieved. So this is again measured along the x-axis. And now I add wave function number two. Yeah, you see? Yeah, it overlaps very well, the pink and the orange one. And then I add the last one. And yeah, you see again, it's the correlations are the same within the error bars for all three wave functions. So again, if you start with a 2x2 system and also 2x4 and 4x4, you can see significant differences in the correlations of the three-way functions. So at that point, they are not really topologically generate, but they become once you go to 6x6. I already could see no difference in the correlation functions.
Is the one particle
density
now exactly uniform?
Yes. Yeah, I didn't show this, but there's no boundary. It's not an exact singlet for every case. Every system size, I mean. And also for the small system 2x2, your on-site correlation here in distance 1 would be significantly different for all three-way functions. But here, the on-site correlations, it's always 2/3. Yeah, and yeah, like I said, this 2/3 is always achieved for every correlation. Also, your single property is also checked and achieved. And so now you have verified that you really have three topological degenerate ground states for the non-Abelian chiral spin liquid state. So when I say I can no longer distinguish these three wave functions, I actually have to say or prove that these three wave functions are actually different wave functions. So in case one could be a superposition of the other two, so then they would be linearly dependent. And I strictly would not have three different ground states. So in order to check this, that I really have three ground states on the hand, I built the overlap matrix of all three states. So consider this to be normalized overlaps. And each matrix element can be evaluated with Monte Carlo efficiently. And for small system up to 8 sites, we also did this on the paper, exact calculation. And so I checked different system sizes, starting from 2x2, where strictly speaking, it's not even chiral because the time reversal is not broken. But I got the result that I have a rank of 3. And then I checked 4x2, 4x4, 6x6, and so on. And I always found the rank to be 3, which means I really have 3 proper defined linear independent wave functions. And before I show you the data, you want to trust your Monte Carlo, so you always have to look at the wave function and see, can I get something from the wave functions just by its analytical properties. And in this case, you can say, if I make a square system, so I take Lx equal to Ly, then two elements here, this one and this one, are the same by symmetries. This comes from the 90 degree rotation symmetry of the square lattice and the behavior of the theta functions. So I would expect these two elements to be the same. And there's another one. I said, if I do normalized overlaps, this diagonal is 1. And those are, of course, related to the three upper elements. So we just focus on these three elements, 1, 2, 1, 3, and 2, 3. And so I calculate the overlaps. And it looks like this. So surprisingly, we found that although our wave function is complex, all our overlaps were real valued. So this absolute value only kills a minus sign in case it's necessary. So, and here you see the red one is 2, 3. And yeah, you cannot see the black one because it's exactly buried under the red one. So the Monte Carlo seems to work and seems to reproduce this result that you would expect this curve to be the same for the two matrix elements. So this again, this is a point of 2x2. This is 4x4, 6x6, 8x8, and so on. So it's a square shaped system. So yeah, you see these decay quite rapidly. And then I make my usual log plot. And yeah, what I get is, you see the overlaps go to 0 rather quickly. And this means for a sufficiently large size and certainly in the thermodynamic limit, I not only have linearly independent states, I also have orthogonal ground states. Yeah, and this, yeah, the decay exponent is just below 1 lattice spacing. So it goes quite quickly. So just now we want to make a cut to more interesting things. We actually want to do something which has to do with the entanglement entropy. So just to just to make sure that we all talk about the same stuff. I guess everyone knows how the von Neumann entropy is defined over the reduced density matrix, which is an annoying property, annoying quantity to calculate, because knowing the reduced density matrix is actually impossible. It's too expensive numerically. But luckily, people defined this other set of entropies. So the Rényi entropies of order n are defined like this. You can recover the von Neumann entropy if you take n to go to one. But also, certain properties are independent of the index n. So for convenience, we now focus on the second Rényi entropy here. And there's this well-known swap operator trick. So maybe I should explain it. Maybe everyone knows it. That I guess it's originally from Matt Hastings, and Roger was also involved. This just the swap trick just means that, do you notice? Do you all notice? You don't? Oh, it's a very useful simple trick. It actually says that I have n equal to 2. This means I take my system and make two identical copies of it. These copies are non-interacting. So if the new ground state of the doubled system would be psi copy 1 product with psi copy 2. And so the swap means just that you define yourself an area, which, like on a torus, it can be the cylinder. And yeah, suppose you have a second cylinder here with the same area. And the swap means that you exchange the degrees of freedom. And you can show this. It's actually like it's just like a two-line proof that this is equal to the trace of the reduced density matrix squared. And it turns out that this is rather easily to calculate, because you just need to exchange degrees of freedom in your wave function. And yeah, somebody asked me that. I think this is the first time that somebody has done this for a spin one system, but it's actually trivial because it doesn't care what kind of degrees of freedom we have, spin one half or spin one. It's just whatever your degrees of freedom you have, you define them. Yeah, you define your area and then you exchange them. So that's very simple. You can also do it for n equal to 3. This would require you to have 3 copies and make the exchange. So it doesn't make sense to go to 3 copies because, of course, it becomes more expensive numerically. So you do the simplest, cheapest case, and that's 2 copies and exchange of degrees of freedom over your area A, which you have to define yourself. And the trick is now what people, I think, first didn't believe, but later realized, that the entanglement, which has this first this area term, and then this topological entanglement entropy gamma, this does not depend on n. It's actually only true under certain conditions, but let's just leave it for now like this. This is independent of n. So for convenience, I take n equal to 2, and I want to extract my gamma later. That's the word how gamma is defined. It's defined via the total quantum dimension here, where you sum over all the dimensions of all quasi-particles. And then you take the log. And it's defined as a negative quantity. So only topological ordered states have a well-defined negative entanglement entropy. Non-topologically ordered state would actually have gamma equal to 0. Technically, there are other sub-leading terms which actually which you have to get rid of when you calculate actually gamma. So there are ways to isolate gamma from this expression. And there are different ways of doing this. What? Yeah?
Sorry, I have a technical question. So when you measure quantum entropy, you're actually numeric. You're actually sampling the average of swap.
Yeah.
So by the other hand, so which is exponential minus s?
Yeah.
So if you imagine you're working with a very big system,
I have a problem with large error bars because the quantity
right,
is exponentially fluctuating.
How do you overcome this problem? How work with the system and how it's
on a later slide. I will comment on this. So actually, yeah, you can say this. I can explain it now. You have to define yourself your area where you calculate the entanglement over, or where you do the swap of the degrees of freedom. So you distinguish two different kinds of areas. So the topological nature of these areas is different. So this is, you can, on a torus, you cut out a cylinder, which has two non-contractible boundaries. Or you do, for example, 11-Venn calculation, which should isolate your gamma. Yeah, a superposition of certain entanglement entropies here should cancel out this area part and just leave you with a bar gamma. And for something like this, the boundary would be longer, which means the exponential fluctuations would be even bigger. And that's why we can overcome this issue, but we first want to focus on the cylinder case, where I check this and I don't have this huge error bar problem. So just a note before I show you this. Like I said, you need to know all the quasi-particle dimensions, which for the non-abelian Mohrid state should be 1, 1, and square root of 2. So 1 is Mariada fermion excitations. So if you plug this in here, you get a total quantum dimension of 2. Yeah, so this is just the first glimpse of the entanglement properties, because everyone knows this famous log 2 also belongs to the Z2 gauge phase. So you have to later work harder to distinguish these two phases. But actually, this would be our value, which we would ideally be looking for a very big system. So just in case that somehow we lose this non-abelian nature and the state becomes abelian once we force it on a lattice, to live on a lattice, then we would have three quasi-particle dimensions to be 1. And if you plug this in, we would get a value of 55. Points to 55, just this for later purposes. But since now we only want to take a first look at the entanglement entropy by doing this cylinder swap. So I will now refer to these. You see, this is one of these circles. I want to refer to one of these circles as a leg. So here you would see four legs, which whose degrees of freedom get swapped. And then you can add a fifth leg and six and so on, and then you can go all over the complete area. And that's what we want to do. So you see, this is not a torus. I have cut this open, but imagine you have peric boundary conditions in this direction and this direction. And yeah, this is now one leg. It's a 12 by 2 system. And this would be equal to four legs here. This would be this point. And here you see S of A is here, this very low point. So that's a very, very thin torus, actually. And now you make the system bigger by building in this direction. So I go from 12 by 2 to 12 by 4. This is only wave function 1, which we right now show. And you see, the value of the entanglement gets bigger.
So the axis is the number of legs in subsystem A.
Yes, exactly. So you basically, yeah. Zero would basically be nothing gets swapped. And one would mean you would have basically the first one blue. Two is the second one, and then you build all around. And also, since there's a symmetry between that we have a gap system is the Encke and T state, which is not even two-dimensional. So I've never encountered a proof in two-dimensional state. that shows that
you haven't specified a Hamiltonian.
No, I know. So here you can see, let's focus on the case 12 by 2. So that's black, pink, and green for the 3x1. You see, pink and black is here, looks the same, and the green one for size 3 is here. So S of A now depends entirely on the weight function. Although the area dependent part should be the same. So it should, there should be some sort of gamma, which is. This is actually true. So, and you see the same for 12 by 4. It's red and orange. It's quite the same. And for 3, it's this one. So you see, S of S now depends actually on the wave function that you're using. So, can you explain this? And I guess I can. And it's also the reason, maybe some people who know this, for example, there's this quite well-known work from Leon Valens, where he does this, the exact kind of plot for some kind of Karomé system. And then he does the same. He keeps one dimension fixed, like I did to 12, and then he made this dimension bigger. He got plots kind of similar to this, and then you can slice through these plots and make a plot S of S versus L, and then you would get some kind of a plot which looks like this, and it would hit the y-axis somewhere here, and this would be your gamma. So this way you can extract your gamma. This unfortunately doesn't work here. I wanted to do this because this here has no, like you said, convergence issue for a cylinder. This apparently comes from the boundary is still sufficiently small. I wanted to do this, but I can't. And this is so because Leon Valens claims that his DMSG always gives him, DMSG gives you a final state as your output at the end of the calculation. And apparently, in his case, this state is always what is called a minimum entanglement state. And I will just later define what this is in a minute. But in order to do this cylinder cut or cylinder slicing, you would always have to work in the basis of your so-called minimum entanglement state. And unfortunately, these states are not natural minimum entanglement states. So for this system, this is actually all you can get from the cylinder swaps. So I cannot get gamma. And if I want to get gamma, I need to move on. So I will just briefly tell you what these minimum entanglement called mesh states are and the relation to gamma.
So what happens if you just plot 3 points for say psi 1 or whatever and look at the intercepts?
The point is you get some nice negative value, but it's not what you want. And I can explain this in a minute. So the point is now that when people say that this gamma is a fingerprint of the topological phase and it doesn't depend on the ground, on the wave function you use, they actually assume that you calculate your entanglement over regions which are contractible, which a cylinder certainly is not, because these two boundaries are non-contractible. And now the point is that you can actually show, and I did the calculation myself also, if you have this cylinder cut, then your gamma now looks like this. Intuitively, you get two gammas from each boundary here, and then you get a correction term. And this correction term depends on these p's. The p's are actually just coefficient of your so-called minimum entanglement states. And the D is the associated quasiparticle, the dimension of the associated quasiparticle. So you get a correction. And this is your dependence in case that you have non-contractible boundaries. And so if go back on this slide, if all my wave functions for all these system sizes would be natural mass states, then my gamma would be 2 gamma plus the correction, but it would always be the same. So I could still make this extrapolation and get this gamma out. But unfortunately, I can tell you that for symmetry reasons, if I make a square-shaped system of Lx equal to Ly, then this is a natural mass state. And psi 1 and psi 2 go together like 1 over square root 2 psi 1 plus minus psi 2. This is a mass state. And in this case, I can calculate my new gamma. But unfortunately, if I move away from my square-shaped system, I can show you that one of these bar wave functions is never a mesh state. So this doesn't work. So maybe I should explain what a mesh state is. Or I actually wanted to say this. It's just, I guess this was invented or realized by Ashwin Vishwanath and Masaki Yoshikawa, where they did this calculation where they pointed out that when people say that gamma is independent of the state, they actually mean that it is independent as long as you work with contractible regions. And then they worked out this formula for this is actually for the second Reni entropy. It also depends on the Reni entropy that you work with. It actually depends on the Reni entropy, and it also depends on the number of boundaries here. And so since it has 2 boundaries, here there's a 2, and there's also a 2. And he called it minimum entanglement states because he said, in this special basis, these mesh states are taken to be in the quantum Hall states. If you cut the system open, you can say you have this Wilson loop operators in both directions. And once you cut it open, these mesh states are the natural eigenstates of these Wilson loop operators. So in that case, it would mean that if you sit on a mesh state and you have an abelian phase, this would be 1, and an abelian phase is always 1. This would be log 1. This would get a maximum value of 2 gamma. Once I remove from my minimum entanglement state and I use a linear combination, I get something which is essentially negative. So it reduces this value. And since once this is 0, once you sit in your natural Wilson loop operator eigenstate, this has maximum value of 2 gamma. And if this is maximum value, then your entropy S has minimum value. And that's why Ashwin and Masaki said they called it minimum entanglement states. So so you have to figure out that this is extraction of gamma if you do a cylinder swap, only works if you always know what your minimum entanglement state is. And I don't know this. I can just, again, by using this 90 degree rotation symmetry for the square lattice and by the behavior of the theta functions, I can identify the mesh states if I have a 12 by 12, for example, system. But if I break this ratio, I don't know. And since in this case, this kind of extrapolation is not possible. And this way, this is, so since this, this is unfortunately this way, we have to move on in order to get gamma. We can do a Levin-Wendt construction, which unfortunately now is numerically significantly harder. So just a word, in order to do Levin-Wendt, you define yourself 4 contractible regions. Yeah, one region is this one here, A, B, C, D. Then you have this, A, D, C, and B, ABC and ADC, and you have A and C, so they are all contractible, which in this case means gamma does not is not affected. If you sample your wave function psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, or even if you do yourself a linear combination, it shouldn't matter. Gamma should always be the same. And if you do this Levin-Wren construction, actually, this choice of these areas is responsible for canceling out the area-dependent part, and it just should leave you with a bar gamma, or actually a double gamma. So just like you said, unfortunately, this has now this is a difficult quantity to calculate because you have huge fluctuations, and the number of configurations which actually give you a zero measurement actually grows linearly with the length of the boundary. And since it's e to the minus, swap is e to, expectation value of swap is e to the minus s, you actually have an exponentially fluctuating quantity. And if you just do it straightforwardly, you just calculate the swap operator and take the negative log, you will get something which maybe is minus 1.5, and then you get a huge error bar of like 1 point something. So the value is completely unusable, unfortunately. So in order to overcome this, you do what is called a reweighting scheme. So the wave function, our complex wave function, can be separated into a sine part and an amplitude part here. So this is the first what you did. And I think also in his first sample calculation, Ashwin and Masaki did this. You separate sine and amplitude. And now the new trick is actually that you cut your amplitude into further parts here. So you have a series here. So it's a product. And like you said, these huge fluctuations in the quantity actually comes from that there are many measurements which are zero. Which means that I can just intuitively say it. After swapping the degrees of freedom, which is your swap operator, you end up, both systems are in states which are not a singlet, which means the measurement will be zero. Maybe a very simple system is what everyone can imagine is actually a diamond model. So if you're a diamond model, if you cut out a certain region, you make a copy of the system and then you swap the dimers, you see it's basically like a piece of puzzle. Either it fits or it doesn't fit. So for a dimer model, your swap measurement would actually be equal to 1 if it fits, or it would be 0. But it has actually the same problem. You have these exponential fluctuations. And this is so, which means that you want to get rid of configurations which, after the swap, lead to non-physical states. You don't want to sample these. And actually, the trick is now that if you rewrite it like this, now your new weights that you sample, they not only contain the amplitudes before the swap, but they are actually a product. They are the product of the amplitudes before the swap and after the swap, which means if after the swap your amplitude is 0, this state will never be sampled. And this way, you can significantly reduce the quantum fluctuation in the measurements. And you do this, you only have to make sufficiently enough of these products here for a bigger system. And then you can do systems for maybe 10 by 10 of total value. But it's still kind of hard because the wave function is numerically expensive because of the Pfaffian. So what we actually have done now, we just started the Levin-Wren construction for a relatively small system of 6x6. This is actually the whole system here, 6x6. And here these single regions are just 4-side and 2-side regions. So it's relatively small. But we did this calculation. And once I checked it, you get a gamma of this value. So the good thing is it's a negative value, definitely. And also the error bar is relatively small. So there's no way that this is zero, because then we would not even have a topologically ordered state. It's below one lattice spacing. So just I mean the perfect value of log 2 should only be achieved for in the thermodynamic limit. So actually for a small system we can be satisfied. And also this value here comes from psi 1, and I also repeated the calculation for the other two wave functions psi 2 and psi 3. And I get within error bars the exact value even. And what I have now running is bigger systems of 8 times 8, 8 times 10, and 10 by 10. This is usually the biggest thing that people can do. So maybe in the literature I have seen for cylinder swaps, you maybe have 120 sites. But for these Levin Wren type calculations, people don't go that far. I guess Ashwin has a system on a square lattice where he only could do 90 sites. And yeah, the biggest thing I have now is 100 sites. It's still running. But I mean, at least it looks like a negative value, which is even a little bit closer to this one. And even just to distinguish, this value is closer to this value, which is the non-Abelian spin liquid. And this was actually Nick's idea. I'm not convinced of this. If for some reason the non-Abelian characteristic would be destroyed once you force the system on a lattice and you would have an Abelian 3-4 degenerate state, then you would get a minus negative, a negative 0.55. And since this value is, even if it's just a small system, it's closer to this guy than to this guy. So it's on the right side. So far we are good. We have convinced ourselves, I guess, that at least this is a topologically ordered phase. And we have to wait for these calculations. But it looks like it's at least kind of closing in on this value. Like again, this value should strictly only be achieved for a very big system. But that's the final result. So we have a proof that this is actually a topologically ordered phase. So this is this is the final result. Just like to discuss open issues, like I said, this is log 2. People also know the famous log 2, which is associated with the Z2 gauge phase. So you would have to say, in order to further tell phases like this one and the Z2 gauge phase apart, you would want to like to know the modular S matrix, which encodes the braiding statistics of the quasi-particles. You can actually extract this, and this is also a new project which I'm working on. And the braiding statistics would be able to tell this apart. And another thing is, I tried to tell you the story. I started with a spin 1 system, which is this Kalman-Laughlin state, which is an Abelian chiral spin liquid. Then I took it one step further. I went to spin 1, which is a non-Abelian Maurice spin liquid, which has now 2-fold degeneracy and 3-fold degeneracy instead of 2. And now I can even go to the next step. I can go to a 3-half. Starting at 3-half and 2 and so on, these are called the so-called Reed-Rosari states. All these states, which have a spin of at least 1, are expected to have non-Abelian quasi-particle statistics. The good thing is that the simplest one, the spin 1 case, it's the one that we can actually investigate. So actually you can start, you can take your Abelian chiral spin liquid, then you make two copies out of it, and then you symmetrize it. That's actually how you can actually write this Maurice wave function. But then you cannot really handle this symmetrization so well on the computer. You notice that you can rewrite this as a Pfaffian. And if you want to go to a 3-half wave function, you take 3 Abelian chiral spin liquids and symmetrize them. But unfortunately, it's not known if this kind of simplifies to something else. We don't really know how to handle this. So this is why Nick and I discussed this. We don't know how to simulate this wave function. But this would be an interesting case, but would be a next project, because the three half case would support what would be expected to support Fibonacci anions. So this way you can, yeah, these are called the read desired states. You can take it always one step further. And we now took the only case which we can deal with and which is non-Abelian, and that's the Moreed state. So that's it. Yeah.
Small question.
Yeah.
Is there any progress done on finding the
fire
limits only for this
Moonreed state? No. That's what Reiter and Tomala did was is actually just some kind of discussion that you I have now placed the system on a square lattice. You can also put it on a triangular lattice, and it's just a very superficial discussion that they said on a triangular lattice. You might come up with certain terms which involve three sides, which could actually kind of stabilize this phase. But there is no real proof. It's just a discussion.
Yeah. So is it possible to have a C1 half system in which there is a non-Abelian topological order?
Spin 1/2?
Right. So
no.
Also one spin 1/2 per unit cell. So if you have two spin 1/2 per unit cell, you can make an effective spin 1, then you can use that kind of construction to get the non-Abelian.
Yeah,
if there's a way to do this for just spin 1/2.
No, there's this conjecture that once you have spin 1 or even bigger, then it's non-Abelian. So,
I guess the question I'm asking is the opposite of it, right? So we know that we have spin 1, then likely we have non-Abelian spin.
Yeah, so you want a non-Abelian spin 1/2 system.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think that's possible.
Is there obvious reason?
No, I think this is part of this conjecture, what people don't have proven. I just checked this yesterday evening when people say that once you take your n number of chirospin liquids, you symmetrize then, and then you have definitely a non-Abelian state. I don't think there's not even a strict mathematical for this way strict mathematical proof. The other way that if you stick with a 1/2 system, it's always Abelian. I don't know. I didn't find a strict mathematical proof, but it's always written in the papers that. Yeah, once you can only get non-Abelian statistics once you move beyond spin 1/2.
So another question is, so you mentioned that the reason that there is a big fluctuation in the swap,
yeah,
that the in some sense when you swap part of the wave function, then they don't match anymore. So you violate some constraint on the Hilbert space. So for instance, you mentioned the dimer model where you swap half of it, then maybe then in some cases the two halves of the system don't match because they don't violate the dimer constraint. So I wonder if you take a more realistic system, let's say I have just bosons that don't impose any constraint on the number of bosons that can exist on the site, then would you expect that the fluctuation actually goes down?
I don't know if you don't fix your number of particles, how you would control this system. And
so
I mean, actually, it depends
instead of having particle bosons, we have just physical bosons and just fix the.
Yeah, but it would depend on your actual, how your actual state looks. If the. I don't think that you can construct yourself a well-behaved wave function where the swap always gives a finite value, because it's just the nature of the Hilbert space that you have very many configurations which, after the swap, are not good configurations. They're not physical states, and these are the states which mess up the calculation.
But in other wave functions, you can, like SU2 RBB states or something.
very
different.
Maybe that's in that's a newer basis. Yeah.
You can have situations where you never get zero contributions to the spot.
Okay.
Possible.
Well, I guess in your case, that's you work on the valence bond basis.
Yeah, ask me some of the
yeah,
basis.
My Kagome RBB wave function is written in the orthogonal Ising basis. I also have this issue, and I also rely on this trick actually. So I guess in this case for the RBB case, it's in that case it's a better choice. The RBB the product wave function is a better choice of basis. Then you don't encounter this issue. So in this case, yeah, you can get rid of this.
But then it's massively over.
Yeah, you pay the price later. You also have a common issue.
Conservation effort.
Yeah. So, yeah, like you notice this spin states they are written in basically in the orthogonal Ising basis when you identify the bosons with spin up and spin down or -1, +1, and 0, 1. So these are orthogonal bases, which also means if I place the system on the square lattice, I would not, on the triangular lattice, I would not have a sign problem. I could immediately do this. But one would expect the same behavior for the triangular lattice. Like, you know, in the RBB case, square and triangular lattice give different results. In this case, it shouldn't matter. It should both be a chiral spin liquid. Doesn't matter if it's a bipartite or non-bipartite lattice.
Did you ever try to avoid the vibrating? I think it's more cheap for calculation.
I'm sorry.
Matrix.
Oh, I didn't calculate this. Yeah, no, it's quite expensive, and
I
also.
Think it's more cheap.
What?
It's more cheap for the calculation. So.
You think the modular S-matrix is cheap?
Yes.
Well, usually, well, first of all, there's an issue. You usually take the Kitaev-Preskill. Like you're referring to this. You take the Kitaev-Preskill construction, you wrap it around the torus, and then you can extract the modular S matrix.
You just try to rotate the torus and then calculate the overlap. So from the overlap, you can directly extract the S and T matrix. So from S and T, you will know all the information about the topological property.
You mean I can directly extract it from the wave function?
From the overlap of the wave functions. After the rotation and the bend twist operations on the lattice.
Maybe I should look it up. I didn't know that. Maybe that's cheaper. I mean the overlap calculation is quite cheap actually. Yeah. There's no convergence issue. So maybe you should tell me this later.
But you'll get a lot of zero contributions that overlap. I don't think it's clearly. If you're sampling in this basis, it's not clear to me that it's better.
In the for the overlaps, actually, well, for basically what you have is maybe if you calculate psi 2, you let's say you have this Ising basis, and then the other matrix element would be maybe psi 3. You would get this, and you would say that this is only non-zero for if the bosonic configuration here, yeah, let's call it IB, is the same as here. So there's never a zero. That's actually the reason why the overlaps converge extremely fast. So this would only have diagonal contributions. So this would be. So that's why the overlaps do not have a convergent issue. You don't measure zeros here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Has anyone worked out the BEPS representation for that?
No, people don't really like this state because it has a Pfaffian, which makes it numerically difficult. And maybe even I should give you the trick because nobody asked when I yeah when once I have two particles sitting on the same lattice side, this guy here blows up, so there's a divergence. But actually, the amplitude is still well defined because it cancels here. How to numerically tackle this is actually just to realize that if these two guys cancel each other, then you could equally replace them by one. So once I have two particles on one side, I give a one here and a corresponding one here. This is how to tackle this. Because first we didn't know this. Because we were surprised that nobody has done this, because it's already a long time since people did the Kalman-Laughlin state, and this would be the next not logical step to do this. But apparently people kind of tend to shy away from Pfaffians, they don't like them. And also the Pfaffian is numerically expensive to calculate. You can do it through an inverse update, and then you can calculate the determinant. But for the swap, you even need the correct sign of the Pfaffian, and this all makes it more expensive. But still it's doable. So, but yeah, perhaps has not been done. So the only people who worked on this were actually Reiter and Jamala when they published the droplet version. The torus version has not really been published. It will be in our paper, and they basically just proved in their paper they made this analytical proof that it's a singlet indeterminate limit, and they had a superficial discussion that there might in some future there might be a Hamiltonian which has this as an exact ground state. That's basically all that's in this paper. So we are the first ones to actually investigate this. And nobody has touched it with PEPS yet.
Right, we can wrap up and thank Julia again.